Welcome to the 33rd episode of A Change of the Chance. My name is Ryan Lowe, and my goal is to educate listeners, especially the youth, on some of the most pressing and polarizing issues in this world by interviewing different experts who can lead us into the charge for change. So here on A Change of the Chance, we've explored many aspects of climate change, from fossil fuel proliferation, plastic pollution, carbon sequestration, to even compostable toilets. The goal has always been to educate youth on the core problems and potential solutions, and hopefully inspire them to make change too. However, despite having a general public ready for change, technological systems ready to improve, and millions of ideas for more sustainable living, why is progress for climate-friendly legislations and greener policies happening at what seems like snail pace? Two words, corporate lobbying. Giant corporations have been lobbying the United States government for many years to impede climate action, which in turn prolongs their gasoline-dependent business models and raises their profits. And you may be wondering why these corporations have so much power here. The answer is complex, but it's important for us to understand the power these corporations hold over our government. So, here to help us explore these nuances of corporate lobbying in the U.S. is Quinn Lewis. I'm very proud to say that Quinn is an alumnus of my school, the Head Roy School. She graduated Harvard last year and wrote her thesis on corporate greed and its effect on climate action. She represents a part of the amazing generation of youth who are dedicated to fighting for climate action, and I know that her perspective will help ignite us to join her in this fight. So, Quinn, it's really great to see you since last time we talked at your talk last year. So how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So on the topic of that talk, you talked about corporate greed and climate action. And I'm just really curious, when did you first realize that this is what you wanted to do, that climate change is something you deeply cared about?
I think, like everyone, climate change is something I've been aware of for a very long time. I think with a problem that is so amorphous and far-reaching, it's hard to see kind of where you fit in, especially when you're growing up. You know, you want to vote for people who care about it, and you think about doing individual actions like composting, but kind of taking one person's actions and extrapolating to the bigger picture about how we, you know, achieve systemic change in the face of this problem was not something that necessarily came naturally to me. I would say even in high school, I was not super aware of this or had not kind of like found my way to plug in. I ended up moving abroad after high school. I took a gap year before starting my undergraduate career at Harvard. And I lived in several places, but one of which was Cape Town, South Africa. At the time, they were experiencing a climate change-induced drought that was very extreme. And that was one of the first moments that I realized the proximity of this threat. It's hard to explain how scary it is to have that kind of resource scarcity. For example, like when I was living there, I had 45 seconds of running water a day. There were, you know, rumors that the government was going to shut the water off. It is a very extreme situation and it's happening now. So it felt no longer like I was protecting my kids or my grandchildren. It felt like I was protecting me. And watching, I was working in a school at the time and, you know, watching fifth graders grapple with a reality that had just dawned on me as someone who, you know, I was 18 at the time. It's hard to turn away from that. And, you know, at 1 year later, or I think maybe 2 years later, the very dramatic wildfires basically shut down the state of California, at least where my family's based. So I guess natural disasters were part of what brought the urgency to my attention. I think a combination of that and going to college and deciding, you know, maybe there is something we can do about structural change. Maybe that these issues are not just about, you know, my individual action, but I have a responsibility to think systemically. I have a responsibility to think about the kinds of changes that are in effect more than just me. And recycling isn't enough and composting isn't enough. So what do I do? And that kind of, you know, led me to the research that I ended up studying towards the, you know, latter half of my college career. I would say all of my research and work did focus around climate change a lot of the time. But this specific niche of thinking about, okay, like what are the biggest impediments to us not achieving climate action? If we assume that individuals are not necessarily going to be motivated to make climate action their number one priority, right? People have to put food on the table. People want to be able to pay for their hospital bills. It's probably not going to be the number one issue of voters at the end of the day. So why, you know, if people don't care that much, if people care a little bit, but not that much, we're kind of in agreement about where the science is, or the scientists are in agreement. Whether or not people believe the scientists is a different question. What are the thing? What, who cares enough to stop the thing that we all know we have to do? And the answer that led me to is corporations, and it kind of went from there. That's a very long-winded answer. And I would also make the huge caveat is I don't know what I want to do in 10 years. I don't know where I want to be necessarily in 5 years. So this was kind of, I see it as like a big chapter that frames the way I think about what I want to do next and how I continue making an impact.
Yeah, I mean, getting that global perspective that you've got, that's got to be really enlightening on one hand. And actually, you were just talking about, you know, your research in undergraduate. And I said it a little bit earlier, I don't know if I got it right. So can we talk a bit more of like an overview of what your thesis really was?
Yeah, I mean, the most simple way to put it is I wanted to figure out if we could predict which corporations would be most powerful in blocking climate policy internationally. So looking at any country's climate policy, if you show me their economy before they even introduce the bill, can we guess or can we predict who's going to be powerful and why? Because when you look at climate policies across democracies, there are various levels of strength and there are various levels of weakness. And it is not the same kinds of companies getting off every time. So generally a policy would pass and you could pass it across, make it equally hard for everyone. And I was looking at, as kind of a proxy for this to test it, I was looking at something called carbon pricing, which is something you can apply across the economy, and it makes carbon expensive. It makes you pay money if you're going to emit carbon. And they're very effective tools. The question is, why are they put on some companies and not others? And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of reasons why some companies are better at handling them. There's like, they can, it's not a threat to whether or not they're able to do business. But I kind of wanted to control for things like how much carbon emissions a company emits, you know, of other factors that might inflate it, control by country. And do we see patterns in the kinds of companies that are getting left out of these policies? And what I found was, you know, on the surface, the answer is no, right? In Norway, it's going to be one industry, it'll be the aluminum industry. But if you look at, you know, other carbon policies in Denmark, it's a completely different industry. It might be pulp and paper or something else. And you could write a very simple explanation saying, well, it's because they're the highest emitters. So they care the most, and so they're going to be the most active. But that's actually not what we found either. When you control for how many or how carbon intense these industries are, it wasn't a perfect match that correlated to whether or not they got out of the policy or were forced to pay. It wasn't that simple either. And it wasn't as simple as, well, is it based in the country or not, right? Because then your question is, well, policymakers care about the people that are voting for them. So they're going to protect those people, but they're not going to protect people outside the country. So it actually started breaking down much more interestingly than that. And there were different threads that I started pulling on, trying to see, are there common economic factors? It might not be industries, right? It might be steel in the United States, but aluminum in Norway and oil and gas in Saudi Arabia. But are there common things about those industries that make them powerful besides the fact that they're carbon intense? If we control and assume that all industries have the exact same level of carbon emissions, what are the underlying factors that, and are we seeing patterns there? Was what I was trying to test. And backing out of that, why that's useful, or the reason why I was interested in it, is I think academia is very, very good at describing things and we can learn from our history. I was interested though in being a little bit more proactive and trying to see if we could create a tool for policymakers to predict political opposition. If in the case of climate change policy. So let's say you're Chuck Schumer and you want to pass a climate bill. Take your economy, run it through this model, and we'll say, you know, these are the groups that are most likely to mobilize, and this is how they're going to be successful. So not only whether or not they're going to be able to apply pressure, but also who do they organize with, right? Are they going to join in with other industries, or is it going to be a single industry group? How do they apply pressure? Is it going to be through lobbying money, or is it about who they employ? Do they employ a lot of people across the entire country? You can kind of identify these, nodes of power that feed into how powerful a given company or a given industrial group or a given corporate interest group is going to be in climate change negotiations. And it's a really big topic. There's a lot more work to be done, but my thesis was like, okay, like, is there even a shot here of doing this? And I think there is. I think that there could be more work in that direction that could make this model even better.
Okay, so very extensive. That's really cool. What do you think was your biggest finding? Like, so you're talking about working on that model. All of that come together.
So the thing that I found that was super interesting is, at least in academia, there's kind of like two groups of arguments about why policy fails or passes. There's the group that, and it's a similar conversation around why Donald Trump is powerful. Half of people say it's about the economy, right? So it's who's paying and how much are they paying? And that's the reason a policy lives or dies. So if people in West Virginia have to pay, it's unlikely we're going to pass that policy because of the way that our government's structured. If people in California have to pay, we might not care as much about that for various reasons. Because of population and whatever, and how the Senate is divided, et cetera. We care about some people's costs more than others. That's one argument. The next argument is cultural. It's we don't do this because we don't believe in it, or that's not who we are. And that's a lot more harder. That's much harder to pin down, right? You can do it through polling kind of, but it's this kind of weird thing that is hard to test or predict. So who counts as American to someone who now votes for Donald Trump but voted for Obama? Those could be two very different answers across a span of 6 years. And like, how do you predict that movement? How do you track it? And how do you infer who's going to care about a climate policy passing and how that changes what their elected representatives vote for? Like, that is all very nebulous. I found that actually the answer is both. And I think you can predict cultural sentiment around certain things. And when it comes to climate policy, my question was, okay, if you look at who gets out of climate policy, it's not just who's spending the most money. There are certain industries that are protected and they don't have to spend any money at all. So what makes them so powerful? And what makes them so powerful is the identity that they hold in the communities that they employ people. And it's this idea called legacy, where yes, they're important employers, but it's not about being an important employer now. Your political power comes from who you employed 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and where they were. Because what we do all day generates an identity. So the most like obvious example of this is West Virginian coal in the United States. They employ fewer people than Arby's. They also dictate whether or not we have climate policy. In Biden's climate policy, there are huge carve-outs for the coal industry, which basically does not exist. When I look at other policies in the US, I'm not seeing Arby's getting huge, sweeping exemptions from their taxes or whatever. And yet we have this industry that is smaller than that, employing fewer people more sporadically, and actively does harm to their workers in terms of health conditions and the communities that they exist in. And it's completely changing what we're able to pass and what we're able to get done. And the reason is they weren't that small 50 years ago. The reason is they're very like geographically concentrated. And so when your dad and your uncle and everyone who went to your high school's parents and maybe your grandparents also all worked for this one company or this one industry, it is part of who you are. It's part of why your town is there. It's part of why your school mascot is the miner. We build our cultures around the things that are happening to us, and industries happen to us. And so there's a predictive experience and there's a predictive cultural outcome if you look at the concentration of industry over time. And it's true in the US. We know this with coal, but there are also other industries like the auto manufacturing industry in the US, or the oil industry in Canada, or the aluminum industry in Norway, which happens to be very, very concentrated because they use the hydroelectric dams in the back of these fjords. So no one lives there except people who work in the, or used to work in the aluminum industry, which has now been exported to India. You see this over and over again in different countries. And if you can take their economic data and you look at a map of who has employed whom and where over time, you're much more likely to be able to predict who's going to or given who's going to oppose the climate policy, given really high emitting companies, who's going to be very powerful and who's going to have that like cultural stickiness that then translates into political power.
Well, first of all,
does that make sense? It's a little it's hard to explain out loud.
Your study seems more like sensitive, advanced, but also more useful than a lot of like big old scientist people posting things about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's also probably less sophisticated in its methods, right? I'm only 24, but I think I wasn't really interested in just giving my opinion. I wanted to make something that people could use to make the world better. And when I thought, all right, like moonshot, what's the thing that would be really great? God, we can't seem to get out under the foot of these corporations. And I don't know if it's ever going to change in the US because of our, you know, campaign finance laws, that might just be a done deal. But what about everybody else? Is there, you know, can we make it easier for the policymakers to not be flying blind when these corporations seem to be extremely calculated and good at what they do?
Well, as from what I know, it's definitely going to make the world a better place.
I mean, yeah, no one's using it, but if I made it better, maybe. It's a good start. Sometimes things are worth starting.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we've been talking a lot about who and why. Let's talk about more about like what. We're talking about corporate lobbying here.
Mm-hmm.
What does that actually mean? And what are some practices that a lot of corporations that we've been talking about actually employ?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff. In the US, we spend a lot of money, right? It's who's going to fund your campaign. There's more insidious things that we do that it's harder to track, right? So corporations will feed into super PACs and kind of hide who they're funding. Alternatively, they'll do this. There's a great academic named Theda Skocpol who is renowned for her work on this, but it was around the Tea Party and it's called AstroTurf Organizations. And instead of just blatantly dumping a lot of money into an electoral race, corporations will actually stand up grassroots organizations and, you know, pay for their merch and pay for their slogans and hire organizers to go into communities. And it will appear as though it's a activist organization. It's super interesting, super dark. And then you have, you know, indirect pressures, which is, you know, certain people care about industry. If it's the primary employer in your town, it's going to change. You're going to vote in the interest of the industry that employs you. Because that's your job. Teachers unions, you know, vote behind the candidate who's endorsed by their union a lot of the time. That's rational. And in the same way, people employed by other industries, like the coal industry or the oil industry, are going to vote for the politician who's in their interest as well. So this kind of economic power turns into political power, both directly through campaign funds, semi-directly through like fake organizations and kind of piping in money and tricky ways that is not legal in all places, but is super legal in the US, and you can basically do whatever you want. And in indirect ways, which is through the voters themselves and the people who have stakes in the industry doing well.
It seems like to me, as you're saying, these corporations don't really stop. They don't got limits.
In the US, not so. I mean, sure, we do a little bit, but in comparison to most advanced democracies, like our peers in terms of government, we spend way more money on elections by orders of magnitude. And what corporations are able to do with their money is much more loose here. They're able to donate basically as much as they want. They're able to advocate on behalf of policymakers. They're able to lobby as much as they want. And it's largely dictated by money. So the thing that's different in other lobbying systems is there might be a cap on how much you can spend, which kind of evens the playing field for smaller companies. Or the amount of access that you have to politicians will be regulated. Or how involved you can be in a campaign will also be regulated. Or how much money you can spend if you're a candidate when you're running for office is capped and it's actually publicly funded. So corporations can't donate at all. These are all kind of ways that other democracies check the power of companies that are, you know, within their jurisdiction that we do not do because we have different laws. And there's a Supreme Court case called Citizens United that overturned a lot of the laws that we had that constricted how companies could behave.
Wow. I mean, we don't ever learn about in any form of school about, you know, corporate lobbying and how different our democracy, our democratic republic is from the rest of the world, just, you know, giving the power to corporations like that.
Yeah, I mean, the American experiment is good in a lot of ways, but it also has its downsides. I also think it's hard to impose rules once you've gotten rid of them. So there's a slippery slope argument here that could be made. Like once you start kind of taking out the teeth of the institutions that are supposed to be a balance to corporations, it's hard to build enough power and legitimacy back to then tell the corporations they're not allowed to do what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So on one hand, we have all the corporations who are doing all these things. What about the role of consumers and their behavior in their demand in influencing corporate environmental practices?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of interesting scholarship on this. I would point you to the work of Michael Hiscox, who's done a lot of randomized control trials around items like fair trade and other consumer labels to see how it influences the behavior of corporations. There's also a fair amount of work by people like Leah Stokes and other environmental academics or climate change academics who are also like pretty plugged into policy, who basically look at, you know, how much power do we have as individuals. Leah Stokes has a really interesting theory of change, which is a demand side theory of change. So I'm thinking, right, supply side, like how do you undermine the intentions of the corporations? Leah Stokes starts from the bottom and basically says like, okay, like how do we make sure that people don't need these things? How do we make sure that we get a lot of technology that makes things like the oil industry obsolete? How do you electrify your house? How do we make sure that the grid is getting modernized? So when you turn on your lights, or if you electrify your house, you're actually not emitting fossil fuels. How do you basically install the appliances to cut these people out of the picture? And that comes down a lot to consumer choice, right? It's which stove you choose. Are you choosing a gas stove or an electric stove? How do you charge your car? Do you have solar panels on your house? All those things, right, can undermine the power of these corporations, because if no one's using their products and they don't have that much money, they're not going to be that influential. And that is much more of a grassroots theory. I think it's probably going to come from both sides. And there are things that policy can do to catalyze what people buy and what it's worth to them. You're seeing Biden do some of those interesting policies with the IRA, for example. He did some interesting things around heat pumps and other ways that we can electrify at a consumer level. So the consumer definitely plays a part. Michael Hiscox, his work is focusing on how do you do consumer choices change the more information you give them? So if there's a fair trade label on coffee, does that make people more likely to buy the coffee? Are they willing to pay more for that coffee if they know it's fair trade than they would pay for a normal coffee? Like these kinds of questions. And I think those apply pretty, or at least I see it as like a pretty direct parallel with things like, are you willing to pay a higher cost for solar panels instead of your electrical bill that month? And then on the long run, you probably save some money. And also, you know, your carbon bill is much lower than it would have been. But that also comes with a certain amount of financial flexibility that most people are not able to have, unfortunately. So yeah, it comes from both. Short answer, absolutely consumers can do things. Get solar panels on your house, get an electric car, make sure your solar panels are charging your electric car. Check in to see like what appliances in your house you can have energy retrofitted so you basically use less, turn off the tap. It adds up if everyone does it.
Well, that's pretty amazing that you already have the sense of like, what do you say, demand side versus supply side. I've never heard that before. That's cool. And what you were just saying seems to be what Leah Stokes talks about. What does Quinn Lewis want to offer to the public about, you know, fixing this problem?
I mean, right now I still think I'm in the part of my life where I'm trying to educate myself as much as possible. Arming myself with as many tools to affect change is kind of the name of the game. So I have not thought critically about what I would say if other people were paying attention. You know, vote. Everyone should vote. There's an election this year. It's extremely important. Vote for all the candidates all the way up and down the ballot. Do not just fill out your ballot halfway. Call your elected representatives. Absolutely. Fight for things that help other people make the right decision. You know, I think in the US especially, there's a lot of inequality that makes it very hard for us to make decisions like getting solar panels. And I think if we tackle other issues here, maybe things move forward. But I think the bottom line is it's a really big problem, and we could say, oh, this is really scary, I don't want to do it, or what role could I possibly have? I would flip that on its head and say, if everyone behaved the way that you behaved, would the world be okay? And you should aim to live your life in a way that the world would not just be okay, but be better if everyone was behaving the way you're behaving, and kind of use that as a rule of thumb of what you should go do and what you can do.
You just talked about earlier, you said you're only 24. Well, you've done a lot for 24 and just a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, it feels like I'm just getting started.
Well, I mean, you are just getting started. You're going to do a lot more in the future.
Thanks, Ryan. Yeah, I mean, look at yourself. I did not have a podcast when I was your age. I was just like, how do I pass history? So it's pretty impressive.
I'm trying. We all are.
Yeah, seriously.
And so we talked about the elections. I have one more question for you.
Mm-hmm.
The Biden administration recently passed a bill that says, you know, we'll be a zero emissions economy by 2050, like most countries have done by now. Do you think mm-hmm. that's actually going to happen or achievable?
I mean, we decide if it happens, don't we? It's a great thing to say. He passed a lot of stuff with it that changes things, right? The economic calculations of whether or not we're going to build more solar panels completely changed stuff, you know, other things like that. Does the current, if you look at a graph, you know, we're above where we were, but we're not at the line that we're supposed to be in terms of decarbonization to hit that 2050 goal. But that doesn't mean that we can't do a bunch of stuff on state levels or individual levels that would get it, that would make up for that gap, right? It's not all on the federal government. It's everyone working together as quickly as possible. So I think it's within the realm of possibility if we continue to pick up the pace. If this is just the one policy we're going to pass and we're all going to move on and like say that that was what we could do, I don't think we're going to get there. But I think there's a lot of people who can probably continue this work and can continue the fight as, you know, see this as a first step. I think it's a very strong first step.
Yeah. And the way you're talking about it, there's some people who are super pessimistic about it. Some people are super optimistic about it. I like how you're just talking about realism. Like, this is what our current situation is, and this is what the future actually looks like, depending on
what. I mean, I don't think that nothing is set in stone. I think optimism and pessimism and being completely sure about where the future is going to go is just, you know, usually comes with an abdication of responsibility, right? It's like, well, it's going to be terrible anyway, so why bother? Or it'll be fine. Why do I have to do anything? And it will be fine if we all work our asses off, is kind of how I see it. It's like, it will be fine because I will make it fine. And I think if more people feel that way, or there's a lot of people who already do, it's just like every single, every nudge, right? Like every little percentage that we can get better at this counts for something. So maybe we don't get all the way there. Maybe we're, you know, 89% decarbonized by 2050, but that's so much better than 75%. You know, it all counts. It's not all or nothing. And I think thinking in black and white terms actually doesn't help us here. I think we should fight for every inch.
You've just summarized the most important part of the climate movement.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's part of it for sure.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Quinn. Not many people, including me, really know about the nuances of corporate grasp on society in general. So please keep bringing this to light to those around the world. Yeah, thank you so much. And hopefully I'll see you again. Maybe you'll have another talk at Head Royce.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Maybe next time we'll be in person.
Yeah, it's been really great. Keep going with your job. You got this. Okay, thank you so much.
Awesome. That was great. Yeah, let me know when it comes out. I'd love to listen to your stuff.
That's it for the 33rd episode of A Change is a Chance. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.